agreements, appeals, and much more. Our complimentary course on the third Tuesday of each month, and an e-learning or online course deal on the fourth Tuesday of each month. We're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you. Yes, Norman, as a reminder, we're going to go ahead and get started with the questions now. And as a reminder to everyone, subscribers do take priority when it comes to this. So check us out on our website if you're interested in becoming a subscriber. I will push a link here shortly to give you that information. But let's go ahead and get started right away with our first subscriber. This is Michael, and he's asking the question, a taxpayer has unfiled returns for 10-plus years and has been self-employed for most of that time. He worked a couple of jobs where they issued W-2s and now received a letter from the IRS asking to file 2014 and 2015. Will the IRS be asking for all the delinquent returns? And client has already indicated records are almost non-existent for that time period. Norman?
Well, first, since the IRS at this point is only asking for 2014 and 15, I would prepare those returns immediately. Now, as to the other 10 years worth of unfiled returns, since the taxpayer is self-employed and also receives some W-2s, the IRS, the first thing I would do is order wage and income transcripts from the IRS for all the years with unfiled returns. So the wage and income transcripts would show the W-2s, the amounts, whatever was withheld, and that kind of thing. Also any 1099s that were issued. Now, if he's mostly self-employed and the W-2s are for small amounts, then the IRS might have determined that he didn't have a filing requirement, and so they may not look for returns from those years. Also, they may or may not have prepared substitute for returns, SFRs, or there may be SFRs in the audit pipeline. But I would get started by, one, ordering those wage and income transcripts, which are different from account transcripts. Account transcripts are based on the returns. Wage and income transcript you'd always order in preparing a delinquent return. And I would prepare only prepare 2014 and 15 at this time.
Okay, Norman, thank you very much. Michael, I hope that answers your question. Moving on to another subscriber, Karen is asking the question, I am new to tax resolution and have only had experience with setting up installment agreements online. How do you decide what the best method to resolve a client's tax problem is? And what is your process? Any guidance would be helpful.
So basically, there's four different solutions to a taxpayer's problem. And the problem, I'm assuming, is that the taxpayer owes more tax than they could full pay within the next 90 days. So the answer would be based on the taxpayer's financial information. So I would ask a taxpayer to at least complete a draft of a 433F, a collection information statement. And based on that information, I would decide whether if there's no disposable income, if the taxpayer qualifies to be put into currently non-collectible status. If there is disposable income, then the taxpayer may qualify for an installment agreement, and there's two kinds of installment agreements. There's a full pay installment agreement where the payments are sufficient to fully pay the tax liability within the statute, and there's partial pay installment agreements where the taxpayer doesn't have sufficient disposable income to full pay the tax. And so the IRS allows them to partially pay the tax. And when the statute, when it reaches the collection statute expiration date, then the tax becomes uncollectible and the payments get applied to the next year. And then finally is an offer in compromise, and that would again be based on the taxpayer's assets and their liquidity and their disposable income. But any determination would always start with review of the financial statement. So the first thing to do is have the taxpayer complete a 433F and then determine which of those four solutions fit that taxpayer's facts.
Thank you, Norman. And Karen, just to add to that, as a subscriber, we not only help you with the actual act of resolving your client's problems with resolution cases, but we can also help you with strategy as to how to take a case from beginning to end. Again, as a subscriber, you are eligible for that consultation time. So I'm actually going to be reaching out to you after this call to make sure that we've answered your questions and walk you through a little bit further if you need that assistance. But thank you very much for that question, Karen. Moving on to another subscriber, Mel, is asking, tax client has been delinquent and paying taxes for over 5 years and owes approximately $80,000. He has now lost his job and is living off of unemployment. I want to submit an offer in compromise, but client just informed me that there is an old retirement account valued at about $90,000. Will the IRS want him to liquidate? Client is 60 years old and will depend on that money when he retires.
So first I would say that remember that an offer in compromise isn't based on the taxpayer's current financial situation. It's based on a projection of the client's financial situation over the lifetime of the collection statute. So if the taxes are over 5 years old, and let's say there's 5 years left on the statute, what the IRS is going to do is they're going to balance the taxpayer's financial situation and their collection ability over the life of the statute, so in this case maybe another 5 years. So the fact that the taxpayer is currently unemployed doesn't mean that he's unemployable, and so the IRS would be looking at what the chances are of him finding work in the near future and increasing his ability to pay. Now, regarding the retirement account, it's not how much it's valued at 90, but that's not the liquidation value. And so what I would look at is the terms of the retirement account, if there's a handbook or something that the employees received regarding their pension plan. And for instance, can the taxpayer borrow against it? So then I would put the value of the pension plan, the amount in which the taxpayer can borrow against, and an offer specialist would look at that as well and determine that would have to be pledged in the offer. So for instance, if his account is valued at $90,000 and the handbook says that he can borrow 50%, so that means that he could borrow $45,000, so that would value that retirement account at $45,000. He would have to borrow that from the account, give it to the IRS in the offer, and then pay back that retirement account pursuant to the terms of the handbook. But yes, that retirement account is an asset, and the taxpayer is 60 years old, so it does have some value, and the IRS is going to look at that asset.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to our next question is asked by Jared. He's an attorney and is asking, if an individual taxpayer failed to file tax returns and IRS prepares a substitute for return and issues the 90-day letter, if taxpayer blows off the 90-day letter and does not appeal, but thereafter files returns that show less tax liability than on the SFR, will the IRS abate the SFR so that the taxpayer only must pay the amount shown on her return? Or should the taxpayer, out of an abundance of caution, appeal the 90-day letter and get to work getting the returns filed right away?
Okay, so the 90-day letter is a notice of deficiency, and notice of deficiency is issued on an audit. Now, the IRS considers an SFR an audit assessment, but I don't recall seeing 90-day letters issued on SFRs. Usually, we get account transcripts, and even then, it shows that it was a substitute for return, and there was an examination later on, which created a tax liability. But if the taxpayer is being audited for an SFR, it seems like I would prepare a return and file it if the return is going to show less liability than the SFR. So for instance, we get this a lot with clients who are, let's say, day traders or have had a 1099 issued on the sale of stock. And so the IRS prepares the SFR without any consideration of the basis. Same thing with sale of real property or gamblers where the 1099 is a 1099-G, shows winnings but doesn't show what the losses are, and so the taxpayer would want to get some documentation from the casino showing what the losses were, so that not all the winnings are treated as income. So I would file a return to counteract the SFR, and remember that if you're filing a return after an SFR, the return isn't sent to the normal place where returns are filed. There's a special unit. It's called the ASFR unit, and you file the return with the ASFR unit. I think there's two, one's in Memphis and one's in Holtsville, New York, depending on where you live and whether or not you're self-employed, determines where you file it, but you would want to file a return after an SFR with the ASFR unit.
All right, Norman. Jared, we hope we answered that question and cleared up the confusion with the 90-day letter there. Okay, moving on. Keith is a CPA and is asking, client has a large liability of approximately $300,000 since 2009. She appealed assessment in tax court in 2011 and lost. Can she now file for BK since it's been over 6 years since original tax was assessed?
Okay, so first of all, I see a couple things. One is, I'm not sure what the 6 years is referring to. In bankruptcy, in order to discharge taxes, and I've been filing bankruptcies for taxpayers that are tax-driven since 1993. I've filed literally thousands, and so I'm pretty familiar with discharging taxes in bankruptcy. And there's a 3-year rule, and that is that in order to discharge the tax, the return had to be more than 3 years old, so that the due date of the return, and that's including extensions. Then there's a 2-year rule, and that is that the actual return had to have been filed more than 2 years prior to the bankruptcy. And the 240-day rule is that the tax had to have been assessed more than 240 days before filing the bankruptcy. So the thing that I see in this case is, one, is that the assessment was challenged in tax court, and those 3-year, 2-year, and 240-day rules toll under certain conditions, and an appeal in tax court is a tolling event. So I would look to see how long the case was in tax court. That would be from the day that the tax court petition was filed until a decision document was signed and entered by the tax court judge. So keeping the tolling issue in mind, I would consult a bankruptcy attorney, because the person who asked this question, as I see, is an enrolled agent. And so although the taxpayer could file a bankruptcy on their own without an attorney, I wouldn't recommend it. And I would recommend an attorney that was knowledgeable on discharging taxes and bankruptcy, which frankly isn't a lot, but it's very tricky, and you want to, first thing that the bankruptcy attorney would do would be to order IRS account transcripts, and from the transcripts do a tax dischargeability analysis and determine if and when those taxes are dischargeable. And although it's not mentioned here, I would also want to see if there's taxes owed to the state. And then a tax dischargeability analysis would allow the bankruptcy attorney to determine when to file the bankruptcy and which taxes would be discharged and whether all of the tax would be discharged or only partial. And then that would determine whether or not the taxpayer would be filing a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And also the bankruptcy attorney would be looking at the taxpayer's assets to determine whether or not there would be any liquidation of assets or whether all the assets were exempt.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Moving on to the next question. Steve is asking, what are the best ways to market tax resolution services? Do you have examples for mail or postcard or letter used? So I'll take this one, Norman, because it's more or less related to the marketing side of doing this. As you know, our goal here is to teach you how to make money. And not only in how to do the actual work, but how to actually attract clients. And right now we do have a sales system that will help you with every aspect of this. Three segments to this full system: marketing segment, sales segment, and then the resolution segment. And right now what we're going to do, this email just went out last night, so some of you might have already received it, but we do have a 25% discount site-wide, which includes a discount on a professional system, the Ultimate Professional System. And for a limited time only, the Ultimate Professional System includes 3 months of the Platinum subscription. So if you're thinking about doing a subscription, but you also want to learn how to market and sell your services, take a closer look at the Ultimate Pro System. And that does give you training, it gives you materials, it gives you examples, case studies, and it gives you all the tools that you'll need to be able to make a successful business doing this type of work. So I'm going to be pushing a link to everyone now so that you can read a little bit more on our website about the Ultimate Pro System, and I'll also push the promotional code so that you'll have it. But just in case you miss it or you don't get it, we will send a follow-up email to everyone after the event detailing the product and detailing the promotional code on there as well. All right, so just a quick little plug there, Steve. Hopefully that you'll take a look at that and see how else we can help you. Moving on to more questions, Norman. Richard is a CPA and is asking, can you explain the first-time penalty abatement program? Under what circumstances will the IRS allow this, and is it difficult to obtain?
Well, the first-time penalty abatement program is an administrative waiver where the IRS may grant to relieve taxpayers from failure to file, failure to pay, and failure to deposit penalties if certain criteria are met. And remember, the first-time penalty abatement does not apply to other types of penalties, such as accuracy-related penalty. So to qualify for the first-time penalty abatement waiver, a taxpayer must meet three criteria. One is filing compliance, in that the taxpayer must have filed all required returns and can't have any outstanding requests for a return from the IRS. A payment compliance, where the taxpayer must have paid or arranged to pay all the tax due. And the taxpayer must have a clean penalty history, and that is, have no prior penalties, so that to qualify, what I do is I call the IRS practitioner priority service, and a tax practitioner can call the practitioner priority service, but they need a power of attorney, a form 2848. And what happens is when you call, an IRS agent who takes the call will call up the client's account on their computer screen and then ask several questions, and they have a program, and they can pretty much tell you on that phone call if the first-time penalty abatement criteria are met, and they can apply the waiver right there on the call and then send the taxpayer within 30 days a letter confirming that the penalty has been abated. So this is one of those low-hanging fruit that we talk about, because you could be a real hero and get the penalty abated with something as simple as a phone call, and the IRS pretty much plugs in all the information and can tell you right there and then whether or not the taxpayer qualifies or not. So it's something that you would want to do. There's really no downside to it. Now, they've improved the program. When they first started this penalty abatement, I was on the phone with the IRS, and they asked a series of questions. I gave the answers, and they said, oh, taxpayer doesn't qualify. So I said, well, just for fun, why don't you ask me again, and I'll give different answers. And we did that, and I gave completely different answers, and the taxpayer still didn't qualify. And then we tried a third time with other answers, and the taxpayer didn't qualify then either. And the IRS agent and I agreed that there was no scenario in which the taxpayer would qualify for the program. But that's been improved now. There was that was written up in one of the reviews and determined that there was something wrong with the program, that nobody qualified. Also, remember that this isn't something that the IRS volunteers. So if you're talking with an IRS revenue officer or some representative collector, they'll never suggest that you use the first-time penalty abatement program. It's something that you need to know about. But again, you can just call the practitioner priority service and ask them, and they'll determine whether or not they qualify or not.
Thank you very much, Norman. I hope that clarifies the first-time penalty abatement for those of you. Funny you mentioned the low-hanging fruit, because that is one of the courses that we do offer, where we do teach very simple, basic things that you can do to not only help your clients and, like Norman mentioned, become a hero, but earn some money fairly quickly on your end. So I'm pushing right now the course list to everybody, so you can see the different courses that we do have available, and you'll find the next upcoming low-hanging fruit on that that calendar there as well. So thank you very much for that. Okay, moving on to Melissa. Melissa's a CPA, and her question is, I filed for an appeal of an assessment for a business client of mine. I received a letter from the IRS stating that they accepted the appeal, and I'm now waiting to have the case heard. It's been 6 months, and I have not received any other correspondence. How long does it take to get on the docket?
So I'm not sure if this is an administrative appeal or whether it's an appeal to U.S. Tax Court, but if you received a letter acknowledging the appeal, they usually say, there's nothing you need to do at this time. We'll contact you within, I've seen it anywhere from 90 days to 6 months. But at this point, I would call the phone number on the letter and find out what stage the appeal is at, because 6 months is stretching it a little bit. And the letter should have had some contact information. So I would call the number on the letter and find out what's going on. Yeah, I think 6 months is just about the right time to check up.
All right, Melissa, hopefully you have some luck there. And if you need some additional assistance, give us a call. Moving on to Jared. Second question from Jared. He was able to get in a few, looks like. For an IRS income tax audit, if the auditor is being slow, rude, and generally a pain in the neck, at what point would you consider speaking to the auditor supervisor or even the IRS taxpayer advocate? Or are those options just a waste of breath?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call the IRS taxpayer advocate, just because I don't think that's the kind of issues that the advocate are best dealing with. You could call the auditor supervisor. You're taking kind of a chance, because I found that supervisors usually back up the auditors, whether they're right or wrong. And so all it does is create animosity and doesn't really get the solution. What I would do is, when the report is issued, they're going to issue a 30-day letter. So if you disagree with the audit report, I would respond to the 30-day letter, and that would go to the auditor's supervisor. And if that level of appeal is denied, then the next stage is they would issue a notice of deficiency, which is a 90-day letter, and I would file a petition with the U.S. Tax Court within the 90 days and hopefully get a different auditor, because believe it or not, even when you do that, sometimes it ends up back through appeals to the same auditor. But at least filing the petition would get you, hopefully, get it reviewed by a second set of eyes that would be more favorable to this auditor who seems to be a pain in the neck.
All right, Norman. Jared, hopefully that helps you with the particular case you're dealing with. Moving on to next question is from Janice. I have a client who got married late 2015 and brought with her a large tax liability to the marriage. There is no prenup, and the husband is concerned the IRS will lien his assets. Apparently the house has equity in it. Notice of intent to levy has been issued, and I would need to prepare a 433A since I suspect it is assigned to an RO. How do I treat the assets as they live in a community property state and share expenses? Also, is there a way to focus only on the wife, who is truly the only one liable for the taxes?
So first of all, if you believe that it's going to be assigned to a revenue officer, that would mean that the taxpayer owes more than $250,000. So that's significant. Also, even in a community property state like California, where we are, there's still some property that is separate and not part of the community property. So, for instance, if the husband is concerned that the IRS will lien his assets, it says home has equity. But if he had that home prior to the marriage, then that may be his separate property and not subject to a federal tax lien. So it doesn't really say, but I would want to know when the property was purchased, and whether and how it's being paid for, whether it's paid by community property or separate property. Remember, the IRS federal tax lien isn't filed against a particular real property. It's recorded in the county recorder's office and attaches to any real property that the taxpayer owns in that county. And the wife may not own this property, so it may not be subject to her tax lien. Now, the husband's income could be something else. That probably is community property and is probably subject to levy, and their joint bank account would be subject to levy. If he has a separate bank account and the money in that separate bank account is his separate money, and the wife has no signatory rights to that account, that may be safe from levy against him. Another thing to consider would be, although there's no prenuptial agreement, would be for the taxpayer and spouse to enter into a postnuptial agreement. That may help. But yes, in community property states, some have 50% of the community property subject to IRS collection. California, 100% of community property is subject to levy. So the lesson is, if you represent a taxpayer who's getting married and one or the other has a tax liability, suggest that they hire attorneys and enter into a prenuptial agreement. That would be very important, especially if there's a lot of assets or money involved.
All right, Janice, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to the next one, this is from Charles, who's also a CPA. Tax client of mine did not make estimated tax payments as instructed for 2 years, IRS and California. Now there is a large liability of approximately $230,000 for the IRS and $90,000 for California. They have not made 2016 estimates either and are now caught in the cycle of owing every year. There are a lot of assets with equity, and husband as an attorney makes over $350,000 a year. What do you recommend I do? If they pay the taxes, they won't have enough for the current estimates. And if they pay the estimates, they don't have enough for the back taxes. I'm trying to avoid liens on properties as they are in the process of selling a rental.
So first of all, I'm always believe in moving forward and looking forward. So whenever there's a choice between paying taxes for future years or past years, I would always suggest future. So this time of year gets a little tricky because 2016 is over, but the return isn't due yet. And 2017 has already started, but the first estimated payment isn't due yet. So what to do? I would look forward and say that any estimated payments from today forward should be applied to 2017, and then I would roll 2016 into the other years and set up an installment agreement for the 3 years. They said the 2 years that already exist plus 2016, so now we're talking about 3 years. And since they owe the IRS $230,000, not counting 2016, I would guess that after filing 2016, that they would be over the $250,000 and they would qualify for their case to be assigned to a local revenue officer. So the thing is, I would try to prepare the 2016 return as quickly as possible. The IRS is accepting 2016 returns now. And I don't know, this says the husband's an attorney, makes over $350,000 a year. I don't know if he's a partner and if he has to wait for K-1, if that's an issue or not. But 2016 return should be filed as quickly as possible. Nothing paid on that. And any money should, from now on, should be applied to 2017. And those payments to 2017 will be credited on the 433A, reducing the taxpayer's disposable income and reducing the amount of the monthly installment payment, because it's more important to stay current and not owe going forward than it is to apply it to the past years. So if you make, so if the taxpayer makes an estimated payment, let's say on April 15th, that would be applied for 2017 first quarter. So I would divide it by three, and that would be the monthly amount that I would apply to the 433A to reduce the monthly disposable income. But to answer your question, that any extra money should be applied to 2017 and not 16 or prior years.
All right, that's good advice, Norman. Thank you very much. Charles, hopefully you got some valuable information out of that. Moving on to the next question. It's from Chris. Chris is an EA, and he says, my office is in Davis, California, and I sometimes get clients asking if the FTB will settle their tax liability. I know they, too, have an offering compromise program, but wondered if it is similar to the IRS process. I have submitted two IRS offers in compromise and feel pretty good about what they look for and need to consider an offer.
So the FTB does have an offer in compromise program, and it is a little different from the IRS on a couple counts. One is where the IRS uses national and local standards, the FTB looks at a case at a case-to-case basis. Although they do use the same standards that the IRS does, they have more leeway for case-by-case review. And also, they don't, unlike the IRS, they don't allow certain expenses without verification. Like, for instance, where IRS allows certain out-of-pocket medical expenses without any proof, the FTB doesn't. The FTB wants proof of every expense. Also, where the IRS formula to determine the amount of the offer is based on a calculation on disposable income and value of assets, the FTB throws in another issue, and that is administrative costs. So, for instance, the FTB charges collection fees because FTB uses outside collection and charges the taxpayer the cost of that service, and they want that to be paid in the offer. So where the IRS has no minimum offer, they can accept a very small amount if they determine that's for the best for the service, but the FTB would have a minimum offer based on their administrative costs. And like, for instance, other state taxing agencies like the State Board of Equalization or the Employment Development Department base their offers on the tax owed minus penalties and interest, so that the minimum they would accept for an offer would be that the the tax is full paid, and they would forgive the penalty and interest. So the FTB does have an offer program. It's different from the IRS and usually ends up paying more for an FTB offer than you would for an IRS offer, even though the taxpayer owes the FTB less than they owe the IRS.
That makes sense. And just so everyone knows, every state is different when it handles or deals with their own collections. So look closer into your own state. We do work with all 50 states, and we've actually done offers and installment agreements and a high percentage of all states. So any questions that you may have in your home state, please don't hesitate to contact us regarding that. Okay, moving on to Alex as an EA, and his question is, I recently obtained a new client who has a tax liability of $506,000. The IRS has started levying his bank account. Since they have already started levying his account, is there anything that can be done to stop it now?
So the answer is yes. And this is the way to think of it. So the IRS has been sending notices to this taxpayer for quite some time. You know, 501, 502, 503, 504, and, you know, they haven't gotten anywhere. So what they say is they levied the taxpayer's bank account to get his attention. So I wouldn't just do nothing, because that's what they've been doing through all these notices is nothing, and that's why the IRS has levied their bank in the first place. So I would contact the IRS and begin creating some installment agreement or something else to determine how the IRS is going to get paid so that they don't have to levy the bank. Also, if there's money in the bank that the taxpayer needs to avoid an unlawful detainer or foreclosure of their house or having their lights turned off by the electric company or something like that, the IRS will not keep money that the taxpayer needs in order to avoid foreclosure or unlawful detainer or suspension of utilities or other things like that. So definitely you want to call the IRS, and you need to do it quickly, because the way an IRS bank levy works is it's sent to the bank. The bank freezes the taxpayer's funds that are available that day, and they hold the money for 21 days. If they don't receive further instructions from the IRS within those 21 days, then they send the money to the IRS. And frankly, once the money gets sent to the IRS, it's really, really difficult to get it back. But if you work with the IRS during that 21-day period, the IRS will fax a release or a partial release of that bank levy to the bank, and the bank will release the funds that the IRS tells them is okay to release, and only send the amount to the IRS that the IRS instructs them to. So it's not too late, and you need to do that before the bank releases the money to the IRS. The bank, what you want to get is a copy of the levy from the bank, and you want to get a letter from the bank saying how much they're holding and what date they plan on releasing it to the IRS, and you want to contact the IRS and get it released or get a partial release before that date. And you want to be sure to get the fax number to the legal department of the bank so that the IRS can fax that release right over to the bank, because usually it's time is of the essence, and you want to make sure that the bank gets that release before they send it to the IRS.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that, Alex. Hopefully that helps you. We are going to be opening up the lines for live calls and live questions. So if you want to go ahead and submit your questions now on the chat box, or if you want to go ahead and just enter your name, I will unmute you to bring you on board. We do have people that have already submitted some questions, so I will get to those. But for now, let's move on with the next question from Alan. Alan is a CPA, and he says that he has an S-Corp client that has Form 941 balances due for fourth quarter 2013, which are approximately $6,150, and fourth quarter 2014, which are approximately $913. This tax represents mostly year-end withholdings for employee stockholders. We currently have an installment agreement for the taxes, but I want to try to get some of the penalties abated through the first-time penalty abatement program. Do I first request a first-time penalty abatement for the fourth quarter 2013 taxes, as those are larger, and also send an additional reasonable cause letter for fourth quarter 2014 taxes? From your experience, do you think that we can get the penalties abated?
Well, yes, if the reasonable cause is reasonable. I don't know what it is in this case, but you could try the first-time penalty abatement program for the fourth quarter 2013, and but I would be prepared as a backup to that to request penalty abatement based on reasonable cause for both quarters, so that if the first-time penalty abatement program doesn't work, that you have a backup with reasonable cause. And I'm not sure what the reasonable cause would be in this situation. Usually it's either circumstances beyond the taxpayer's control, or it's a reasonable reliance on advice of a professional. So I don't know what grounds it is. I guess the penalty, it doesn't say what the penalty is, but I guess it's the failure to make federal tax deposits penalty. And I'm not sure what the grounds for not making those deposits timely are, but sometimes you can use the reliance of a tax professional that they instructed the taxpayer that it wasn't due at a certain time, or that it wasn't due at all, or that they could file it, pay it with the return. There's different issues. But yeah, I would go ahead and try it. The failure to make federal tax deposit penalty is one of the penalties that can be abated under the first-time penalty abatement program. But again, I would prepare a reasonable cause defense for both quarters.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Alan, hopefully that helps. And if you need to, give us a call, and we'll see if we can provide additional assistance. Next question is from Jared, also an attorney. Actually, I think we've answered a couple questions for Jared already, so let's try this last one. For income tax adjustments made to an 1120S, does IRS send a notice of deficiency for the S-Corp, or do the adjustments just flow through to the individual's taxpayer's notice of deficiency? So if individual taxpayer wishes to petition to U.S. tax court, does he or she just file the petition in his or her own name, or is the petition also submitted in the name of the S-Corp?
Well, no, the audit is based on the 1120S. So if the audit report gets issued with the notice of deficiency and the taxpayer disagrees, they would file a tax court petition on behalf of the S-Corp. And then the results of that would flow through to the individual, but the actual tax court petition would be in the name of the S-Corp, because that's the entity that's being audited. Probably they're denying certain expenses, and so that would be an S-Corp petition, not the individual.
All right, Jared, hopefully that takes care of that. Moving on to these questions people are submitting online. So this is Jody. Jody is asking, client had someone prepare an offering compromise that was denied. He owes approximately $98,000, and the original offer was $16,000. I reran the calculation based on the original 433A, but used the national averages when appropriate. My offer amount is about $4,000 more than the original. Can I submit a new offer? The client has no assets and income is approximately $80,000 a year.
Yeah, you can, but I'm surprised that usually when an offer just doesn't get rejected, there's usually some negotiations that happen, and the offer specialist would say, well, based on our calculation, the taxpayer can offer X amount, and you go from there. So I would want to know if what the offer specialist came back with, what number. Sometimes they come back and they say, based on our calculations, the taxpayer can fully pay the tax, so he's not a candidate to an offer, or otherwise they come back with some number greater than the offer amount, but less than the amount owed, and the taxpayer can negotiate and come up with some number that the offer specialist will accept that's greater than their initial offer. So yeah, I would see what the offer specialist recommended at the time that the original offer was rejected. They usually come back with a counter offer.
Yeah, it's never just a no. It's usually some sort of a negotiation there. So thank you, Norman, for that. As a reminder, I do have a few more minutes left. If those of you who want to get a question answered, now is the time to submit it. Brian is asking regarding the taxpayer advocate service. We talked about it earlier, Norman, and he wants to know, when do you contact the taxpayer advocate service?
Well, technically, you're supposed to contact the taxpayer advocate if you can't resolve an issue with whoever from the IRS you've been dealing with, and it's creating a hardship. So if they're levying and the taxpayer can't make ends meet from the levy and they submitted financials and the IRS rejected the financials or whatever, that would be taxpayer advocate service. So it's a situation where there's some kind of lien or levy that's negatively affecting the taxpayer and causing them hardship. That's why I said it wasn't really appropriate for a case where there's an audit and you just don't like the auditor.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Norman, for that. All right. Moving on to the next question here. This is from Payosha. I have a client who is married with one child. He has a second job in which he received a 1099 form for a few years. I filed his taxes from 2009 till now, a few months back. He now owes $26,000. In September, he got very sick and almost died. He ended up quitting the second job due to his health. His annual income is now only $35,000. He's 41 years old and has a few stocks. Can he be a candidate for an offer in compromise with the state of New York?
I mean, based on that information, yes. And again, I would complete a financial statement and determine whether or not an offer is the best solution, or whether or not a low payment installment agreement, or whether or not he's currently non-collectible. Maybe his health is going to improve and he's going to go back to working a second job. So again, you need to start by, for an offer, for instance, you can complete a draft 433A OIC, and at the end of that 433A OIC, it does a calculation and it determines what the taxpayer needs to offer based on the value of their assets and their monthly disposable income. So you might want to do that, and you can determine what amount they would need to submit for an offer.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. You know what? I know there's a few more questions coming in, but we are almost out of time here, so I'm going to have time for one more. And on that note, Norman, Sam is asking, what if a client doesn't have any assets and no disposable income after completing the financials? Can you just make an offer of, let's say, $500?
This is the IRS.
The IRS.
Yeah, so yeah, the IRS will accept an offer for $500 if the 433 AOIC supports that amount. Yeah, it could work. It could work for less than $500.
Right. So the
and remember, an offer is based on ability to pay, not on amount owed. So it's not like the FTB that it's based on ability to pay and amount owed. IRS is only ability to pay. So whether they owe $50,000 or $500,000, $500 may be an acceptable offer.
Right. So it's formula driven too. So make sure you pay attention to those numbers. All right, ladies and gentlemen, so that's going to conclude this month's Tax Practitioners Forum. I want to remind everyone to please look out or check out our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org for the full menu of items that we offer. And please don't forget the 25% site-wide discount that I pushed in the chat link. Again, take advantage of that. For those of you who are looking to grow your practice, you can look at our subscription program. You can also look at the Ultimate Professional System, which now comes with 3 months of the Platinum subscription. The promotional code has been pushed in the chat box. I'm going to push it one last time before we go here. But as a reminder, I will be sending this out to everybody via email. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed today's call. As a reminder, our next call is not till March 7th. And we will do it all over again. Thank you all. Have a great day.